This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. That place is City Hall. The person we're talking to now is a man named Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, the nation's second largest city, and one that's been through a lot over the course of the past couple of months. Streets that have seen a fast-spreading virus move through, large crowded protests against police brutality, and hundreds of National Guard troops. Mayor Garcetti, thanks for coming on.
Great to be with you as always. Thank you, Steve.
Let's start with the protests. The LAPD has been heavily criticized for instigating rather than responding to violent clashes with peaceful protesters. You made it clear recently that you wanted the LAPD to limit its use of rubber bullets and batons against protesters. I'm guessing that you had some of the same concerns. I mean, what's your take on how the LAPD has handled these protests?
Well, you know, first of all, just it's difficult to have one single brush because everybody's experience is their experience. So any harsh police tactics that we saw have no place in Los Angeles, and they tarnish, you know, the professionalism and care that thousands of officers show every day. And luckily, not because we're a better city, but because we've gone through these tough moments in the past, we have a civilian police commission inspector general who's reviewing footage, ensuring a full investigation of any incidents that are depicted that are using excessive use of force, which could lead to officer discipline or removal. And I always caution people, every incident has a larger context. Our officers must keep the peace, but without violence. Whenever necessary and whenever possible. And this is a really transformative moment for our city. I've been really pleased in the last few days. Protests this week have been just so powerful, so peaceful. And, you know, we need to focus on tearing down structural racism, both in our communities and our government institutions. The police, you know, need to be a part of that. But also, we need to make sure that we widen that out beyond just what we see in policing, because there are larger issues at stake.
I mean, I mentioned the rubber bullets and the batons only because, you know, even some journalists were hit. One of our own journalists was hit by a rubber bullet, as a matter of fact. And I you know, if I were to shoot a rubber bullet at somebody or hit somebody with a baton, I would be arrested, right? I mean, I would be held accountable. And I wonder what you're doing to make sure that that happens.
Well, we have to make sure, as I said, that, you know, we say first and foremost, harsh police tactics have no place in Los Angeles. And then secondly, where there's any complaints, and I encourage folks who have been the victim of anything to make sure that gets reported to our inspector general, who is hard at work. I know they're like triply and quadruply working hard around the clock. It is true. And, you know, you can have 200,000 good interactions between police officers and protesters. But if you have, 200 that are bad, that are filmed, that are real, that people feel, those have to be addressed. They can't just be swept under the carpet. It is a part of what this healing moment has to be about. And more than that, forget this moment of just protest. If we don't have that all the time, we don't have accountable policing. And to me, that is a cornerstone of good constitutional policing, of community-based policing. And I hope that there's lessons learned. I know when things were happening in Fairfax, I was with the chief of police. We saw it on TV. And there's some dangerous situations. The night before, you know, I think officers had taken a lot of bottles and bricks, and one had nearly died with a fractured skull. But an overreaction in the face of that is not always the best reaction. And we have to make sure that people can protest and that we protect those rights. And I'm very proud that LAPD for years has marched alongside the Women's March, has been able to, you know, help people in 2017 when the president was sworn in and we had night after night after night of protest, and do that peacefully. But that is never an excuse for excessive force.
Let's talk about the push to defund the police department in many cities across the country, including Minneapolis, which the city council just voted to begin the process of dismantling its city's police department. There are calls like that at LAPD as well, which has obviously a past instances of brutality. The city has paid out probably hundreds of millions of dollars over the years to settle such claims. Until recently, you supported an increase for the LAPD, even though the city's revenue is way down. Now you're saying you'd like to take maybe $150 million out of the budget and maybe spread it around. Why the sudden change of heart?
Well, not if we don't rise to this moment, first of all, we either meet this moment or we miss this moment, full stop. And not just with policing. By the way, I want to be very clear, it's not just in the police department. We kept all of our programs for the entire city in place. There was a numerical raise in PD to meet the cost of living, but there was functional cuts in the police department, even in the earlier budget. But I think that all of us recognize at this moment what people are saying, and that we have to listen and hear that at this moment, if we don't see our budgets as moral documents and a reflection of our values, that not just from a police budget, but also from our entire city budget, what are we doing to address the fact that Black Americans start so far behind the starting line in our economy, in our health, certainly when it comes to the experience they have with policing across America, the criminal justice system? You're more likely to be in jail, you're more likely to be sick, you're more likely to die of COVID-19, you're more likely to be homeless, you're more likely to be undereducated and or underemployed if you're Black in America. So to me, it was kind of crystal clear. And by the way, it wasn't an awakening. The largest growth in our budget over the last 7 years have been around the intervention youth programs, our fight against homelessness, things that disproportionately affect not just Black Americans, but also other communities of color. And I think that's the right thing to do. So a narrative that somehow the police department has grown and these other things have not, couldn't be further from the truth. We had $12 million for homelessness a few years ago. Now we're going to be this year at $696 million. We stepped up in the midst of a COVID-19 crisis to make sure we weren't just trying to save lives, but erasing that gap that had Black Angelenos dying at twice the rate of white Angelenos, something we've closed by halfway already due to the public testing centers that we had. So this can't just be about one piece of the budget. And, you know, we need to have public safety and think, what are we putting on the shoulders of our officers that they don't deserve to have on their shoulders? They can't be the answer to everything having to do with homelessness and everything having to do with mental health. They can't have the answers to every social ill. And yet, I think across America and Los Angeles, while in many ways has been more progressive than others, still fits into this criticism. We've just kind of thrown it all into what usually is the biggest department, asked police, you know, officers to answer those calls. They've done many times, and I won't stop saying this because I've seen it up close, heroic work of getting people out of tough situations, responding to violence in homes and sex trafficking and rapes and things like that. But I think we probably put too much on their shoulders. And it's time for us to collectively think about not just police budgets, but our entire budgets, where we're sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars at the county level, at the state level, our federal government giving tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans right now, instead of investing that in places where you can't get a loan to start a business if you're Black. Those are the conversations I hope that this sparks, that it inspires, and it moves other cities and levels of government to start doing the right things, to not just saying we're against racism, but we're going to actively put our money where our mouths are.
But respectfully, sir, I mean, you said we have to meet this moment. Why did it take this moment to draw so much attention to it?
I think the history of America is always when people take to the streets and social movements demand more, demand an acceleration, demand this moment, that either you turn your face away from that or you listen and you do more. That's what a democracy is all about. Why has it always taken moments of crisis for us to do better? Depression, war, segregation. I don't have those answers of why these things exist. They don't just come, you know, from government. They come from us collectively. So if we don't all own this moment, say in our workplace, what we're going to give up, who we're going to hire, who we give the raise to, who we give that loan to if we're a loan officer, how we educate, whether we step up when there's things on the ballot like Measure EE last year, which went down with not even 50% of vote, which would have given Black and brown children much more of a start in our public schools. I think it's a collective moment, but why this moment? Because of the trauma of it. We saw what we know happens, not with a knee to the neck, is happening every day in America. The fact that if you're living in Watts, you have 12 less years of your life statistically than if you are born and grow up in Bel Air. So, you know, that's not something that just comes out of a government program. That comes out of where we have prioritized as a society and in how we spend our public monies. But I can reassure you, it did not start 2 weeks ago. This, you know, movement to, for instance, take our gang reduction youth development programs and expand them by 50%, that was a victory that the community, City Hall, and others can claim from 7 years ago. That people said, we need to invest in homelessness, and we passed not just one, but two measures. That happened 4 or 5 years ago. when we start looking at the things we're trying to do, those of us who spoke out against tax cuts for the rich, who want to have healthcare for everybody or make college free, for instance, we've made community college free together with our community college district and boosted in 1 year by 46% the number of kids from LAUSD going to college through our community colleges. So this is part of an ongoing struggle. What this moment demands is even more that we stretch beyond maybe what we think our grasp is, and that we reach beyond that, our grasp, and go further as a city, as a state, and as a nation.
Are those protesters, though, the ones who, by the way, protested in front of your house several times over the past week, are they not seeing these implementations of ideas that you're talking about, of moving money to inner city projects, things like that? Because there's that cry from so many people that you're not listening, and the breaking point isn't that far. I mean, what can you do to ensure these folks who are demanding change in policing in LA get the change that they're screaming for?
Well, I think you absolutely have to let people know, A, that they're being heard, B, let them know the victories, which are not a list of things that politicians did on their own. They usually were a response to community organizing and the tough, difficult work that is always about reallocating resources and raising the funds and pushing things forward. Reducing the number of deaths at the hands of police officers, which were 21 just a few years ago, down to 11 in LA. That, you know, we can go through each one of them and see which ones still are unacceptable. But that those are hard-won victories from activists who I hope this moment invites people from the street into the process too, because the momentum is clearly with change. This is a moment I've been waiting for my whole life too. Pushing those balls up a hill when there's nobody around. You know, I was talking with a friend, said, hey, were you there when we needed to have that, when we had that town hall to open up a homeless shelter? Were you there when Measure EE was on the ballot last year, which would have had a lasting permanent change on our education system? Will you be there this fall when Schools and Communities First, which will change what Prop 13 did to the state, will we organize around that? Because that affects Black communities first and foremost, and other poor and communities of color. Will we do those things together? Or will it be, hey, you know, the only emotion I have is the rage of this moment, and I don't want to learn how budget works. I don't want to figure out, I want to have demand of just burn the thing down. We know that the change has to come when all of us find the common ground now and say, yes, more than ever before, it is time to accelerate justice, accelerate a racial equity lens, abolish Proposition 209, which may be on the ballot this fall, and get engaged and involved in those things that for the young kid being born today will have a lasting effect on her life beyond the criminal justice issues, which are so critical at this moment. It has to be much bigger than that if this moment is going to mean something.
If the city council comes to you and says, we want to defund the police department, we want to dismantle and find another way of public safety, what do you say to them?
Say that Los Angeles has done a lot of dismantling and has a lot of work still to do. I'm very curious to watch and to understand what that means in places. I think that for me, the most important thing is models that work. There is actually common ground. I don't know if you know the Community Safety Partnership, which was something that came out of community organizing and a demand for a different policing model. It started in our public housing developments, then has moved now under our leadership into neighborhoods for the first time. And instead of police officers being in a place for 2 years and then cycling out, they stay for 5 years. And knocking on doors is a big part of what they do. Like departments like Camden, New Jersey, which have kind of fundamentally reinvented themselves, have done, where they mentor and engage and build relationships, not just respond to calls. I want to see that expanded. We need public safety, but we have to understand what the police department is really good at and where we still need to keep growing, and those things that maybe shouldn't be under the responsibility of a police department. So I think that's the way we should go about rebuilding from this moment and building on this moment. In other places where it's so broken, they have to start from scratch. I respect that. But I think there's been too many people with too much blood, sweat, and tears in the changes that we brought about in Los Angeles to full-scale abandon that. And by the way, it would have a huge impact in our city tomorrow when there is a young girl caught in sex trafficking, when there is somebody who's waiting for their rape kit to be processed, which used to be years and now is done in weeks. You know, these things have impacts on public safety, but it doesn't have to be an either or. It doesn't have to be tear it all down or support the status quo. We have to be very impatient. We have to be very demanding in this moment, and we have to be very smart. And I think a lot of that is looking at where we put resources, figuring out a better way to do it, and looking at what works in a way that builds trust. Nobody should be traumatized by their police force, and vice versa. People should be able to depend on a police force to be there when they need them. And then the third thing is we need to look at what builds safety that has nothing to do with policing. Youth programs, health indicators, homelessness, educational systems. If we think we're going to erase, if we say that Black lives matter and that Black bodies are matter, if we humanize this moment, it is brought on and continuously policing is a piece of this. But if that is the only focus of this, we will miss this moment. We will miss that this moment is about that there's $17,000 per Black household in America of wealth and $171,000 in every white household. There's just no fair start to begin with. And to me, that's as important work for all of us to do, including myself, in the next couple months. If we're going to create community wealth and opportunity and erase racism, it has to be material as well as procedural.
Well, I know I speak for a lot of people whom I've spoken with over the past several weeks, and they do say that they don't feel safer when the cops show up, and that needs to be addressed, sir. And I hope we do get to some address to that.
Well, and no question, that comes from accountability, including during these protests. It comes from the ongoing work we do to make sure that knocking on a door is as important as answering a 911 call, and that we root out any culture and misconduct. I saw videos recently where we had police officers saying things that have no place in this department right now. But vice versa, too, it means recruiting people from our community to become police officers. It means continuing to add the reforms, like we said, the eight can't wait, the national campaigns that have helped us reduce, the number of fatal police shootings, so that now we're 82nd per capita out of the top 100 cities in America, rather than close to the average. These things actually save lives. And those feelings are things that I think our police department leadership and officers need to hear. And vice versa, we need to open up the spaces for, you know, the mental health of our officers and the support of our officers and the training of our officers and the recruitment of our officers and the rooting out of our bad officers and not passing them on in the state and having independent prosecutions when people do break the law as officers. Those are all a piece of us all feeling safer, from our officers to the people that they serve.
Mayor Eric Garcetti, thank you for coming on. Thank you for taking the time.
As always, Steve, thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's head on over to Orange County. Protesters all over the country, in the streets, even in the OC, are demanding police reform. That includes defunding the police, as we talked about, or seriously reducing police budgets and increasing money that goes towards supportive services and housing and education. But as you know, the police union is a powerful force. In OC, they helped fuel the ouster of a Santa Ana City Councilwoman, Ceci Iglesias, who had resisted a pay raise for police officers. Gustavo Arellano is with us now with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
How powerful is the police union in Santa Ana? Is that the sole reason why Iglesias was recalled?
Ceci Iglesias had very few fans. And think about it. She was the sole Republican on the city council. She was a vocal supporter of Donald Trump. She had even trash-talked high schools in Santa Ana, even though, you know, she's from Santa Ana. But what set off the recall wasn't her many opponents, but rather the power of the police union. So this is a union that has been flexing its political muscle now for the past couple of election cycles. And it's gotten a lot of candidates that go with a police union line, which is give more pay raises for them. And in this past election cycle, there was two who opposed pay raises. One was Ceci Iglesias. Another one was Juan Villegas, who's a sheriff's deputy. They opposed it. So what the police union did was try to recall both of them. It failed against Villegas, but it worked with Iglesias.
Let's talk about Orange County as a whole, the broader county. The sheriff's office there has seen its budget grow year after year, correct?
Oh, yeah. Discretionary funding. So this is when the Board of Supervisors, they could, you know, they get a certain amount of cash and they could dole it out however they want. It has doubled for the sheriff's department over the past decade. Meanwhile, discretionary funding for public services has actually gone down. So remember, this is Orange County. At least the old Orange County was a quote unquote law and order place, suburb. So, of course, police officers were viewed as kings, as the white, you know, white knights, cavalry, all those cliches from heroes of the past. And any little bit of resistance to police brutality was always met with outright dismissals, if not accusations that the critics were socialists.
Well, of course, I mean, the protests that we're seeing in the streets all over the country, but also in Orange County, are at the very least drawing some attention to allegations of police brutality in NOC. New attention being paid to the death of a man in Anaheim in 2018, Christopher Eisinger. What happened there and what's the latest? There was a civil suit, right, from the family.
He was just one of many men over the past 15 years in Anaheim who died at the hands of police enforcement. In this case, there was video that showed a bunch of police officers on him, very much like George Floyd. He ended up passing away in the hospital. And with most of those cases in Anaheim, nothing really came out of it. If the video came out, people got upset. And that was kind of it. So in recent days, of course, the family came out and tried to remind right now the country that, hey, his life mattered as well. All the men who have died at the hands of Anaheim police officers, African-Americans, yes, but also Latinos and white men even, their lives mattered as well. And enough's enough with these law enforcement officers in Orange County and their encounters, many times brutal, with their victims.
I mean, there was a big news conference yesterday in the case of Eisinger. We also remember the case of Kelly Thomas in Fullerton, where police beat him to a bloody pulp and then he died a few days later at the hospital.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many cases. You know, when I was at the OC Weekly, I was used to say we had been covering killer cops before people were even paying attention. There's so many notorious cases. I mean, the one that I always remember in the early 90s, the Huntington Beach Police Department, they killed a World War II veteran, a 70-some-year-old man who was living in his factory. And in almost all of these cases in Orange County, I actually can't remember any off the top of my head where there was an actual conviction of a law enforcement officer for criminal intentions. On the other hand, there's been millions of dollars in civil settlements, especially in the city of Santa Ana. So, and there's been activists who have been saying this for years, but I think this is what makes the rallies in Orange County so historic. It's not just Santa Ana or Anaheim anymore. I mean, you're seeing Rancho Santa Margarita, Yorba Linda, Nixon, literally where Richard Nixon was born. Ladera Ranch. Ladera Ranch is like this super wealthy, exclusive suburb down all the way down in South County. And you're seeing protests against police brutality and for Black Lives Matter. And this in a county where only about 2% of the population is African-American. It's absolutely historic.
Are those protests, though, getting, I mean, what kind of reception are those protests getting in 2% Black Orange County?
For the most part, positive. I've been covering a lot of them for the LA Times, and I always hear the horns honking in support, very few people yelling at folks. Of course, there has been confrontations in the places you expect. In Newport Beach, a real estate agent pulled out his gun. In Huntington Beach, you have people shouting HB matters as Huntington Beach matters, so on point for Huntington Beach. Mission Viejo, you have counter protesters saying go home or whatnot. But those are the last vestiges of the old, nasty Orange County. Like I always say, this is not your grandpa's Orange County. Heck, it's not even my Orange County.
Gustavo Arellano, who writes for the LA Times and joins us for KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. In the middle of a pandemic that's affected California in myriad ways and large crowds decrying racism and police brutality, something all too familiar to LA, you probably didn't have earthquake on your bingo card. Yet here we are in Southern California with a couple of medium-sized temblors over the past couple of weeks. But you know what? I wanted LA's most famous seismologist, Dr. Lucy Jones, to join us to talk about what was happening with those quakes east of the Sierra Nevada. But then I saw a tweet that she sent that made me want to talk to her about something else. A tweet about racism in the sciences. Here's what she tweeted. Geoscientists, we are one of the least diverse scientific disciplines. Call for a robust anti-racism plan for the geosciences. Well, Lucy Jones is no stranger to this program, and welcome back. Thanks for being here to talk about what you wrote.
Oh, glad to be back.
I mean, this is an issue, racism, in all the sciences, right? I mean, why particularly in the geosciences, do you think?
Well, it is for all the sciences, partly because we are much more subjective than we want to believe we are. You know, the academic researcher, we think that all of promotion comes through just being the best possible researcher as quantified in your peer-reviewed papers or whatever. The reality is it's a pretty subjective process to decide what's the best science. It's a very few superstars where it's really blazingly obvious, but mostly it's much more subjective. Geosciences, I think there's a lot of reasons, and one of them probably is that historically, a lot of the geosciences were connected to the mining and oil industries. And that's been a place that's been more, just had more racial issues. And it becomes just part of the milieu. And it's not people being racist per se, perhaps, but a system that just tends to keep them out. You know, I had a follow-on tweet with that with somebody asking, you know, is it by action or by their choice? If someone knocks at the door and you don't answer, that's racism. If they just don't even knock on the door, that's something different. And I actually replied, yeah, well, if you've got the door miles from where the nearest bus stop is and those who can't afford a car have to walk and perhaps get accosted by a few bad apples for walking in the wrong neighborhood, then you're dealing with systemic racism. And
you're talking about the hurdles, right? The hurdles to get there.
Right. But I think it's more than that. I think it's once you're into that, it's just so hard. You know, I mean, at a lesser level, really significantly lesser level, when I started in this field, when I first got my PhD and came to Caltech, I had to dress like a complete slob because if I looked nice, I was assumed to be the secretary. And, you know, that and you react to that in different ways. My reaction was like, all right, I'll show you, right? But it can also be a reaction that just says, I don't belong here. And I think that goes on as well. And, you know, I for many years, I just said, why would an intelligent African-American choose to go into the earth sciences when most of the jobs end up in a Gulf Coast oil field? They're just going to choose to go into a profession where they don't have to deal with as much as this. And I excused it that way. But I think there is a lot that once they get in, they, you know, the whole... the hurdles, but also that subjective process of what's a good scientist. I ended up seeing some cases with African-American colleagues that were just held to a ridiculously higher standard. And people who could not see that they were doing it.
That is racism. That's institutional racism.
It's institutional racism. And then just, again, when there's too few people there, it perpetuates itself that way. And I, you know, it's so hard to say I was wrong. And we usually don't like that space that if we can give you something right to jump to, it's a lot easier. And I think at this moment, it's going to be really important to give well-meaning people a way to react that acknowledges that they can accept that they were wrong, but now I'm doing the right thing. It'll help people make the jump.
It's such a hard conversation to have. And we all try and have this conversation, and we all try and be introspective about how we feel about things and wanting to do right by everybody, all of our neighbors on this planet. And before we let you go, I do want to ask you about these earthquakes, the aftershocks, like as it were, from what we've had east of the Sierra Nevada mountain range in Ridgecrest. We saw another couple of moderate ones that happened, right?
Right, and not as it were. Those really are aftershocks. All right, so, I mean, the aftershock's just a name. But What we see is that when one earthquake happens, the rate of earthquakes in the area where that first one happened jumps up. And mostly what happens is near in time, near in space, and smaller in magnitude. And we've got equations to describe that. And one of the important things about those equations is that the relative number of large to small earthquakes is a constant. You've probably heard this, that for every magnitude 7, there's 10 sixes, 100 fives, 1,000 fours, 10,000 threes, etc. And so that when the rate jumps up, it jumps up with and keeps that distribution. And then the rate dies off pretty quickly. We use the name aftershock as long as the rate has stayed above what it was before the first event happened. So the bigger the earthquake is, the longer the aftershocks last because the rates jumped up even more with the bigger earthquake. And as long as something happens in that same place, what's called the aftershock zone, within the time that it's still above the rate it was before, that's clearly an aftershock. And go look at any map of, you know, we have online those real-time earthquake maps for the last week. You can see the whole line of aftershocks that were, you know, starting back in 2019, you know, 11 months ago, continuing on. And this earthquake was clearly within that, and there have been over 40,000 earthquakes recorded in there in the last 11 months. Wow. So with all of those little earthquakes, we need to have a few big ones to keep that ratio constant. And so these type of large late aftershocks are actually really common.
We've covered a lot, Lucy Jones, seismologist and author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Lucy, it is always nice talking to you, and wow, what a heavy subject, all of them that we tackled today.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for having me and for, you know, everybody, even when you're a seismologist, you need to be thinking about the racial inequities in American society.